This is side two of the first tape of the Dorothy Jones interview. When the tape ended, you were talking about a house in, was it in East Lansing?
Yes.
Or was it in East Lansing in the 1960s?
Right,
that you were
right.
looking at. And
we looked
and you
at
said
it.
The price was $21,000 for you.
Mm-hmm.
And then would you tell what the rest
and
of
then,
the story?
And then we had some friends go by because the people were saying, that doesn't look like it's worth it. And then they said, let's go by and see. And so it was $10,000 for them.
Mm-hmm.
And so we said, of course we didn't want it because of that. And as I said, the house, every time I go down Harrison Road, I see it, and it is empty, and it's been empty. The paper moved for whatever reason, I have no idea, but that house has been empty for at least 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's my mother used to say, God don't love ugly. But there's another piece to this that's interesting is, okay, we looked around and we could not find anything that we really liked. Turns out Francis Fine was a builder in this area. And not too far from that place, you go off the street, they were building a new subdivision. And according to federal regulations, anybody could look at area and choose to build a home. And so my husband went, and he told them that he was interested, and they said, well, okay, we'll get back to you, and they didn't. So every day at lunchtime, my husband would come and sit in front of the office where they were trying to sell the houses, and he'd greet everybody who came up to the door. And so they finally said, well, it doesn't look like he's going to go away, plus by now, we had gone to
FHA?
Yes, mm-hmm. yes. And said, you know, something's not right here.
Mm-hmm.
So we said, but we don't really want that house anyway, but we want to build here. So we told them that we wanted to buy a house in that new subdivision. And they said, okay. Then they tried to give us one of the worst lots on the site. The place has at least 65 houses, and they had been digging for this one house, and they had run into some problems.
They wanted to give you that site?
Yeah.
Or let you buy that
right,
site?
Right, right, right. Uh-huh. So we said, no, we didn't really like that anyway, because we were surrounded by people, but we preferred a property that banked against an open field where we saw deer and all kinds of. It was just beautiful. And so he at first tried to give us grief on it, and we said, nope, that's what we want.
Mm-hmm.
Do you really want me to be in touch with FHA?
Mm-hmm.
No. So we built there, and we still live in that house.
Still live in that
mm-hmm.
house.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So were you surprised that East Lansing was as segregated as at the time, at least in Hubbard?
Well, we didn't think it would be. And it technically wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
But it shows you what people can do to try to keep the status quo in place.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, overcharging us,
mm-hmm.
and then not showing us the property, and then wanting to give us what was one of the worst lots, because they eventually built on that, but they had to do something to the soil and all kinds of things before mm-hmm. they did it. So it was surprising, but afterwards, as we got to know Bob Green, he and Letty were dear friends, and we were members of the same sorority and all. We found out that his life was even more miserable than ours.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was that people had not changed much. And there may be some places in East Lansing where it's still the case, but I think people have learned over the years you don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
And you can not socialize with people, but you can't discriminate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
After you were pleased with your house that you built there?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we built, they had specs.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you could choose one of those. And so we chose one that was, we thought, very nice. But then later on we decided, oh, it wasn't quite big enough for us, so we added on a new family room in the back, and then we added two bedrooms upstairs. Mm-hmm. So, as I said, we've been there for a long time, and whereas we now, as I said, have a small home in Durham, North Carolina, mm-hmm. that our home is still off of Harrison Road, up near Lake Lansing. We remember where Myers is now, was all open field with deers and everything, mm-hmm. and our subdivision blocked Knapp's. Knapp's had wanted to build a store over mm-hmm. there where Myers
is now. Yeah.
And we were, our subdivision, oh no, we want this to be kept just open for the animals and the wildlife and everything. You see what we got now.
Of course, they were just bare sighted in the in the East Town Center. That's maybe the animals were there,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes. I said, oh yes. And I said to my husband, I said, we haven't seen a bear in years, but it just shows.
They're shopping at the East Town Center.
Yes,
Eastwood.
Yes.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. What? How was it that you ultimately came to work at Michigan State?
Okay, my background was social work, as you said. And what you do is, in order for students to graduate, they have to do internships. And so then you have to be supervised by a licensed and trained social worker. So that's what I did. Had students. One time I had 5 students, and that was unheard of. Hmm. But the school felt that I was doing a good job, and they thought that I could do it, and so I did. Then the School of Social Work asked me if I would come and teach a course. And from that it was, would you be interested in being on the faculty here? And I said, well, if I can work part-time, because our children were young then and I did not want. And they said, well, faculty schedules are not like everybody else's schedules. You have some flexibility. So I finally said yes. And so then I came on, at first as a supervisor. That was before, as I said. But then came on as an instructor.
Okay.
Because I did not have a PhD, mm-hmm. I had a master's degree.
Okay.
And so, therefore, I taught various courses in the master's program, not in the we had an undergraduate program, but I always taught in the master's. But then it was, okay, you've now learned about something else related to colleges. It's called a tenure system. Mm-hmm. And I did not have a PhD. And so they said, well, you know, we love having you here, but you're not going to be able to advance unless you have the PhD. And so that's when I went back to Smith College, because they had a PhD in social work program. And the way it worked, you fit well so that I could, because classes were all in the summer.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the way Smith has always done it. And so went there and got my PhD. And obviously I had to do a dissertation and all of the usual stuff and present it and everything. And that was fun. I did, my study was looking at synchrony in the relationship between babies and their mothers.
Hmm. Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I did videos.
Uh-huh.
I did videos of these, and then we did analysis of the videos, and then I wrote it out.
Mm-hmm.
But of how you could see how the, and we had it actually set up over in Baker Hall. They have a one-way mirror and some rooms on the first floor. Mm-hmm. And so we had the camera set up, and we could watch the mother playing with the baby in the other room and not have to be involved at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had some measures that looked at when was the mother in synchrony with the child.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was my dissertation research of looking at. And I had families of color and I had white families. And one of my primary conclusions was that where there were variables, both the black mothers and the white mothers were in synchrony with their children. And as a matter of fact, the African-American mothers were more in sync with the children because they could do, they did not always have to talk with the baby in order for the baby to respond. It could be a touch, it could be a click, that babies learn to react to that. And so it was the whole range of options of way of communicating that I think made a difference in terms of how African-American children develop. They have a sense, a greater sense of the range of ways you can relate to people, starting from those earlier experiences.
Very interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah. How? So you did some of your work on at MSU.
Oh, yeah.
Your research here, but it was directed by.
Right.
And who was your major professor at Smith? For your. For the PhD.
Ann Hartman.
Ann Hartman. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, she's now. The fact that she would take me on, I was like in seventh heaven because she was considered just one of the best in the country. Mm-hmm. And actually, you know what? She was my guide, and that was good because she said, you can do this. Mm-hmm. I don't need to have to hold your hand.
Uh-huh.
And so it was a great experience. Mm-hmm.
Did your work as a social worker allow you to come to that, to pick that dissertation, or was there something, what was your area of specialty before you went into teaching? Was there, were you dealing with families or women and children?
I was dealing with families and I was dealing with women and children. Mm-hmm. And it was my looking at synchrony in the relationship between the mother and the babies and doing a comparison.
So you were doing that in the real world, so to speak, and then applied
Right, and then I did videotapes of the mothers with their children, so that we had a cohort of guidelines, and then we look at them and say, okay, this, but still saying there may be some variability there, but this is giving clear evidence of mom is in synchrony with the baby, and as I say, one of my favorite was this African mother who, most of them were African-Americans, but there was one who was an African, and she was so wonderful. And what she did was a click back in the back of her throat, some back there. The baby would respond to it, and there could be different dimensions to that click, that the baby sort of knew that it was a happy click, or it was one where baby, maybe I'm not doing something that I'm doing something that I shouldn't be doing. Mm-hmm. So it was just fascinating.
Yeah. Was that a personal thing, or was it a cultural within her village, or where she was found?
I think it was a cultural thing.
Okay.
Yeah, but primarily from her village, because as I learned more about where she was from, that there was a lot of nonverbal kinds of things. Mm. Yeah. Mm. And another piece of this, is that during all this, I was dancing.
Really?
And I started my own dance company.
Okay.
And
when was that?
Oh, goodness. We celebrated the 25th anniversary, maybe about 5 years ago. It's called the Pashami Dancers. And I went to Africa, took people to Africa. We studied, went to seven West African countries, and to South Africa, and then to Brazil and Trinidad. And so I would go and then bring that back and do performances here with the company. And we've done performances in the Fairchild Theater. We've done them on the Wharton main stage and on the both of the Wharton stages. Matter of fact, my husband is I asked him how many tapes we had, and he said we had... I think he said we had 350 tapes. Wow. And so he's DVDing them, all of them.
Wow.
before they, you know, because they are, some of them are old, before they really deteriorate.
To preserve them, that's important.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's interesting.
And then I walked in one day when he was doing it. I said, oh, they look kind of good. And we made all of our costumes. I mean, not like our outfits. I didn't call them costumes. All our outfits. Mm-hmm. So it was really a family kind of thing. Mm.
Mm-hmm. What does the name mean?
Pashami means togetherness. When, see, you don't know, you got a talker here. When Bishop Desmond Tutu came, I may have said something to this, but Desmond Tutu first came to this country and to Detroit. My company danced for him, and some of the dancers never forgave me.
No.
He gave us a standing ovation.
Wow.
And we have it on video.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yes.
Did you meet him personally?
Oh, yes. Yeah. And he gave us all hugs. Mm. Oh, yes. He was a gentleman. Mm-hmm. And to me, it was my interest in African dance did so many things for me, but it also did so much for the community. Mm-hmm. And the thing, when we had the program welcoming him to this country and to Michigan, the dance companies in Detroit were angry with me. They said, how come you got to dance for him and we didn't? I said, I didn't do anything. They asked me, and so I did.
How did you recruit your early dancers?
I would go to community centers and
in the greater Lansing area?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
And I'd watch people, what they were doing. And then I would, and I'd say, you know, I have this dance company. Why don't you come and try something? I'm doing some African dance. I said, yeah, come try. And, okay, I'll come. And then I had drum, because you have to, with my, our work, we had live drummers. Mm-hmm. And so it was that you don't do African dance to tapes if you really are being as authentic as you can. Mm-hmm. And so we had people who were interested in drumming with us. And we had a master drummer who had studied under the best African drummers in this country. He was my lead drummer.
Oh.
He's dead now. He died of AIDS. Mm-hmm. But you know, that's what happens with some situations. Mm-hmm. But I went for authenticity, and it was important to have people who knew it well. And as I said, I've done them all over Michigan, and the one that I did in the correctional facility, we got a grant from the correction department.
Okay. In Michigan?
Yes.
Yeah.
And so
which prison were you?
It'll come back to me in a minute. Mm-hmm. Muskegon Correctional Facility.
Muskegon. Okay.
Yes. And so for 8 weeks we went every Saturday there, and we had to go through the metal detectors and everything. Well, it turns out that the head of corrections was a friend of my husband's. And he put the word out that you make sure nobody messes with any of those dancers or drummers. They're going to be in trouble. So we went for 8 weeks, and I think about the third week, so I told him, we did a little performance, and then I said, well, we had this opportunity to teach you some of the dances that you've seen us do. And I said, okay, but if you don't do it, you're going to have to sign up for the whole time. And yeah, okay, and then they did. And later on, not at the end, but later on, I had a group. We had a little debriefing after one of the classes. And I said, okay, watch it. I want to be with these good-looking women. So it's been all kinds of interesting things like that. But anyway, the head of corrections, I said, knew that. And so through him, it got back that I really wanted them to do a performance. Mm-hmm. And so they got the warden and everything. And so I said, okay. But I said, we can't just get up in what they usually have. I said, I want them to have Bermuda shorts and shirts. And the warden said, okay. Then here I am up in the sea with these big bats, mm-hmm. tied, and they're tying their shirts mm-hmm. and their Bermuda short. Mm-hmm. They dipped them in, and then they got them, and then, you know,
tie-dye shirts.
Yeah, did tie-dye shirts, and then, you know, tried to do it. That was more like African, the African style, which is more crunch mm-hmm. than those concentric circles that we all did. Mm-hmm. And so, the day of the final performance, when we walked through those gates, they were all standing there in their outfits, just so proud. And we did the concert, and it was shown throughout the Michigan correctional system, over and over. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And a few of the people who were there kept in touch with me, because I gave them my address. Mm-hmm. I give my address. I felt mm-hmm. very comfortable in doing that. Mm-hmm. And to hear the stories, that's where I was a social worker too. Mm-hmm. Because some ended up calling me mom. Mm.
Interesting.
Oh yeah. Mm. It, because I was the closest thing to a mom they had ever had. Mm-hmm. And so that was something that I think changed my dancers. I think it changed me, and I think it had some impact. And some of them wrote me for a long time after that. Mm-hmm. But we just did so much with dance where people had never seen African Americans, and to see us do something that was well done, and it wasn't, you know, something that we were going to jail or something, mm-hmm. but to have it as part of a culture. So we are not doing it now, mm-hmm. but I felt that those 25 years were very good, and the university here always supported me. Mm-hmm. The provost always supported me. Mm-hmm. And then, because I was doing all these things, and I moved from the School of Social Work, and I was then an associate dean in the graduate school. And from there, I moved to the provost's office as her diversity officer. Mm-hmm. And that's where I retired from.
Okay. When you came back and you finished your PhD, did you come back to a 10-year appointment, or did it take a little time before you got...
It took a little time. You don't automatically get it. Yeah.
Were you able to publish any of your mm-hmm. dissertation? Okay. Mm-hmm. Right. In either article form or book form? Or?
Yeah, all articles.
Articles. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Right. And where I did, the first one I did was the one where I was comparing the analysis of the mothers with their babies in from different cultures, mm-hmm. and using videotapes. So I videotaped mothers with their babies in Africa and then mothers with their babies here. Mm-hmm. And so most of my research was cross-cultural.
Okay. Mm-hmm. When was your first experience in going back to Africa, or going to Africa? Do you remember?
That would have been first time. I know I was out of...
Mm-hmm. You were an MSU prof at that time?
No, not the first time.
Okay, the first time you were...
Not the first time I went. But so after that, I think I did go with support from MSU.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
And then went to, as I say, five different countries in West Africa and South Africa.
Okay.
And so I was able to get support from mm-hmm. Michigan State. So I was sort of this strange person who wants to go off and do these things and let her do it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What was your relationship with David Wiley and the
Study
Center?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. David Wiley and I are still good friends. We don't see each other as much as we used to, but I was very much, that's my social worker's my core, and my other affiliation is with the African Study Center. Mm-hmm. So over the years, and he was always supportive of what we were doing, because nobody else was doing anything like that. Mm-hmm. And I got to know his family very well, and we never were in the same place in Africa, but whenever I would come back and And then I was part of the core faculty of the African Studies Center. Mm-hmm. So it was very much a good relationship, and I was doing something that no one else was doing. Mm-hmm.
Okay. What were some of the courses you taught in social work before you did some
interviewing, I taught cross-cultural issues, I taught supervision, I taught, oh goodness, things, I'm trying to think, in the clinical area of what where you're supposed to develop the core competencies, I think I did all of them, except group work.
Okay.
But supervision, direct practice, work with couples. But I didn't do groups. My husband was the group worker.
I see.
But and then administration. Mm-hmm. I didn't start in it because you could major, you could have administration as your track. I didn't. That wasn't me. I mm-hmm. preferred being involved directly with people and making a difference that way. Mm-hmm. But later on, as I became more involved with the university, I did take on. Administrative roles, but my love had always been the direct making an impact on people's lives directly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You mentioned, I think we talked before a little bit about Gwen Andrew and the fact that she just died not too long ago.
Yes.
She, as a dean, did you work with her in what ways?
She had me do some work in her office too, but it wasn't. I wasn't assigned to her office. She would use me for various projects, and I was on lots of committees out of the dean's office. And she'd say, "Dorothy, I want you to do such and such." And I said, "Okay, Dean Andrews," because I was always on it.
Yeah. Mm.
But anything she wanted me to do, and I, matter of fact. Even after she retired, a friend of mine that I had known from way back when I worked at Family and Child Services was a dear friend of Gwen. And so we would get together each month for lunch. Mm-hmm. And Gwen was still, and I didn't call her Gwen. I called her Dean Andrews. I mean, she'd say, "Call me Dory, call me Gwen, you're Dean Andrews to me." And so, but up until the last time we had a lunch together, which was too long, when Nancy Press and I were talking about later, that we let it slide and we shouldn't have, because we didn't see her right near the end. Mm-hmm. But we'd ask her which restaurant she wanted to go. She loved the one in Williamston, right on the, just as you go in the city,
okay,
and it's a nice, it's homey kind of thing. It's mm-hmm. it's Williamson, mm-hmm. and then other times she'd say she wanted to go some other place, and we basically just listen because mm-hmm. she loved to talk, and she knew so much mm-hmm. about people. She knew so much and had such insights into what was going on here, mm-hmm. and she'd say, "Oh, I don't know about that person." But it was never anything where she demeaned anyone. Mm-hmm. It was always, her conversations and comments were always in the context of what is in the best interest of the university and what is the best interest of our students learning. Mm-hmm. I mean, I always thoroughly enjoyed it. And matter of fact, when we first started doing it, I felt in awe of her mm-hmm. because this was, I mean, she was one of the first women mm-hmm. deans around mm-hmm. here. Yes.
One of the colleges other than Human Ecology.
Thank you. Yes.
Was there anything in terms of her as an administrator that you modeled? I mean, your own experience as an assistant dean? You have different things when you're assistant dean.
Right. But I guess the one thing that I think I learned from her is that you don't have to make quick decisions. That sometimes if you don't think about clearly of what it is you want to do, that something's not going to go right. Mm-hmm. And if people are trying to push you, then just tell them you aren't ready yet. And then you give it some thought, and then you get back to them. So it was her saying basically to me that I had the skills, and don't let people bamboozle you mm-hmm. into trying to make you do something that you don't want to do. But so she, as I said, she had confidence in me, and that's how a lot of people found out about me. That's how the provost found out about mm-hmm. me. So
that and this is Lou Anna Simon?
Yeah. Uh-huh,
yeah. When yeah. she was provost? Or
mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah.
What was your nature of your work with her?
I was her her diversity officer.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And that was the position I held when I retired. It still meant that I still taught some, mm-hmm. but primarily my job was diversity officer. And I'm bragging on myself.
You should.
Because one of the things she said that was my responsibility was the Martin Luther King March. Mm-hmm. Prior to her